Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The Biden administration's border reforms risk undermining the basic foundations of international human rights and refugee law, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said on Wednesday, taking aim at the expected rise in so-called expedited removals from the United States. Mr. Türk also criticized the intention to use the Title 42 public health order even more than today. The move will permit the fast-track expulsion to Mexico of 30,000 Venezuelans, Haitians, Cubans and Nicaraguans each month, the UN rights chief maintained. He explained that Title 42 has already been used by U.S. immigration officials 2.5 million times at the southern border to expel people to Mexico or their home country without assessing what risks they faced. The High Commissioner welcomed the extension of the U.S. humanitarian parole program to include nationals of Cuba, Haiti and Nicaragua in addition to Venezuelans, but he insisted that the measure should not come at the expense of fundamental human rights, including the right to seek asylum and the right to an individual assessment of protection needs. In Uganda, a deadly outbreak of Ebola virus has been stopped in its tracks and declared officially over. The UN World Health Organization, WHO, said on Wednesday, infections have reached major cities Kampala and Jinja, fueling concerns that the disease could extend well into 2023. In 2019, Uganda experienced an outbreak of Zaire Ebola virus. Head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, congratulated the authorities for their robust response to the outbreak. Less than 4 months after the first case of Sudan Ebola virus was confirmed in central Mbende district. In all, 55 people died and 87 recovered in the latest outbreak, according to WHO, which noted that no vaccines yet exist to treat the Sudan strain or 5 other Ebola variants. The UN Health Agency provided nearly $6.5 million for the initial response and an additional $3 million to support readiness in 6 neighboring countries. Practical support from WHO included deploying experts, providing training in contact tracing, testing and patient care, as well as building isolation and treatment centers and providing laboratory testing kits. To Cameroon, where life-saving humanitarian assistance for communities displaced by violence or flooding has been shored up thanks to a $6 million boost from the UN's Emergency Relief Fund. Announcing the news, the UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, said that Cameroon's different humanitarian crises affected 3.9 million people last year. Because relief needs continue to be severely underfunded, thousands of people have gone without vital humanitarian assistance. But thanks to the $6 million contribution from the UN's Central Emergency Response Fund, help will now reach those most in need in the far north, northwest and southwest regions with protection, shelter, food and nutrition assistance, explained humanitarian coordinator in Cameroon, Matthias Nab. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day today. We had some slight, what they call snow showers last night. It wasn't much, way less than an inch, but it did pile some snow up on the road. Nothing too dangerous. Hell, it melted off by the time it was commuting time. I hope you're having a great day. This is, we're going to try something new today. Lee Camp, you may be familiar with Lee Camp. He is a stand-up comedian. He used to do several shows. He did a show in Kansas City. He used to be a traveling comedian. And he has done the most censored news. He is one of the most censored comedians, he claims, in the United States right now. But Lee Camp has been reading news lately for Behind the Headlines, which is available on YouTube. You can get it. But today he's trying to do headlines of a different sort. Of course, he's got a comic edge to him. Normally, we have headlines and cop headlines from Democracy Now!, but Amy Goodman seemed to be a little late today getting them out. So we're going to do Behind the Headlines with Lee Camp. It's about weapons contractors and reading fairy tales to children. And we'll be back with you.
Hello, boys and girls. This is the story of how a UN report just said that at least 11,000 children have been killed or maimed in the U.S.-backed war in Yemen, even while the weapons contractors who are making bank from this Dante's Inferno are reading fairy tales to British children. No, like, seriously.
Welcome to Engineering Fairy Tales. My name is Hannah, and I'm an aircraft technician with the British Army. That means I work with helicopters, fixing things from engines to hydraulics or just a flat tire. I'm going to read you the story of Hansel and Gretel.
What fresh hell is that? We'll get back to the dystopian fairy tales that'll be forever burned in my brain in a moment. You probably already know that Saudi Arabia, one of the world's richest countries, has been bombing Yemen, the fifth poorest country in the world, since 2015, with support from good old Uncle Sam. I mean, come on, does Saudi Arabia even need the U.S. to destroy the fifth poorest country? It's equivalent to Barry Bonds in his steroidal prime playing baseball against your asthmatic, cross-eyed, five-year-old cousin, and then he stops to call over Mark McGwire in his juiciest prime to hold the kid down. Can you tell I haven't watched baseball since 1999? The United States has put its military might behind the Saudi-led coalition, waging a war without congressional authorization per use. That war has devastated Yemen's infrastructure, destroyed or damaged more than half of Yemen's health facilities, killed and injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. But of course, it's killed far more than tens of thousands, because more are killed from the famine and the disease a war causes than from the actual bombs. This is utter insanity. And Yemen is just the tip of the iceberg. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, the U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 37 million people in and from Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria. 37 million people, and that's the low estimate. But let's not be all negative about this. I hate when people just show the grim side of death and destruction. How about the fact that a lot of people are getting very rich from this endless assault on the people of Yemen? There's a positive, right? Do you have any idea how many heated towel racks this war has bought for investment bankers? Do you have any concept of the number of silver-lined bidets that have been installed thanks to this war? The war in Yemen has been particularly lucrative for General Dynamics, Boeing, and Raytheon, which have received hundreds of millions of dollars in Saudi weapons deals. But let's not leave out the British war profiteers, who are the most polite of the merchants of death. They always have a spot of tea to rinse down the partially congealed blood patties they alligator gulps down their throats during the standard ritual celebration following the signing of each arms deal. I love the Brits. BAE Systems sold 15 billion pounds worth of arms to the Saudis during the Yemen assault. And that number is actually 2 years old, so it's many billions higher than that now. But BAE Systems doesn't want us to only think of them as serial murderers. That is just one of their many talents. Here's what they tell the British people they're really all about.
My name is Dale. I work at 41 Squadron, RAF Coventry, as a survival equipment specialist, which means I look after everything that helps keep the pilots safe while they're flying their aeroplane. Would you like to hear a story? Well, welcome to Engineering Fairy Tales. Today, I'm going to read you Jack and the Beanstalk. So get comfy and listen closely, because Jack might need your help at the end of the story.
Okay, I've had fevered nightmares involving clowns wearing eye patches and involuntary Brazilian waxing that weren't nearly as terrifying as that story time. First of all, I assume that guy is being held in a black site with a cheese grater pointed at his gonads. Why else would he be doing this? Secondly, why do we need freaking military to read our kids fairy tales? Hi, kids. I've chalked up 35 kills over the past 2 years, many of them children, just like you. Now, settle in, because I'm getting ready to read you the original shooting script for the film Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The part of the chainsaw will be played by this bile-stained sock puppet, which once held my neighbor's foot. Third, this series of children's storytime videos is paid for and branded with BAE Systems. So they sell weapons of death, and they have a side hustle of reading fairy tales to toddlers. Something tells me the story time is not the real money maker in that scenario. And this whole story time thing, it doesn't make them less creepy. It actually makes them creepier. Like if someone told you they were a hitman and a juggler at sleepover parties for tots, isn't that worse? As The Independent reported, the fairy stories are just the latest example of a marketing blitz on schools by military contractors and suppliers who collectively spend millions of pounds a year promoting their brands in schools. Isn't it intriguing that they're allowed to promote militarism and killing to the young, impressionable brains of our youth, but no school is allowed to promote a million other important and actually beneficial and crucial ideas, such as alternatives to capitalism, there's one, or the idea that wage slavery is still slavery, or the concept that nation states are a ridiculous way to delineate the world when we should all be united as humans to create a better, sustainable, comfortable, hell, breathable world, because we're just tiny flesh balls trying to survive on a minuscule grain of dirt flying to an empty black void at unimaginable speeds. Can't teach that in the schools. Can't teach the youngins that a pretty large percentage of marriages are a form of miserable imprisonment. Can't teach them not to touch the comforters in hotel rooms, because if you have a black light up to those things, they light up like a Christmas tree. Be an episode of CSI, for God's sakes. Aren't allowed to infiltrate young brains with the idea that most police just act as a fist of the fascist state to defend the highly exploitative status quo. Can't introduce the concept that there are drug dealers who spend decades in jail if caught, and other drug dealers called Big Pharma that make billions and continue to just run free on the streets. They don't have to hide from the cops. In fact, they have ads on television every day. Can't teach any of that, can you? But you can lovingly tell a six-year-old that military personnel are his friends and they want to help out with story time. You know, if they get a spare minute between dropping drone bombs on goat herders outside Kabul. So why does BAE Systems put out story time videos? It all comes down to image. Image for weapons contractors like BAE, Raytheon, Lockheed, General Dynamics is very important, because if their image gets bad enough, rich people stop investing in them. Take, for example, Elbit Systems. Elbit Systems purchased the government-owned Israeli Military Industries, IMI, in 2018, which granted it an 80% monopoly over sales to the Israeli land forces. This cemented the firm as the largest Israeli arms company and also turned Israel's arms industry from mostly government-owned to mostly privately owned. So investors for Elbit get rich while the company destroys the lives of Palestinians. Elbit Systems is known primarily for its military drones, specifically the Hermes, which have been used repeatedly in Israeli military operations in the Gaza Strip. The company also produces components for the illegal separation wall in the occupied West Bank. I mean, define illegal. If you're already killing a bunch of innocent people, then hearing someone say, that wall is illegal, kind of loses its gravitas. However, Elbit Systems' image has taken a hit in recent years. Even HSBC divested from the Israeli arms company. HSBC is one of the largest banks in the world, which is known for laundering hundreds of millions for drug cartels. In fact, HSBC was profiting from an international criminal scheme even while on probation for having served murderous drug cartels and other criminals. So HSBC divesting from Elbit Systems is like a cannibal walking up to you and going, man, what you're doing is it's just wrong. Have you no sense of decency or ethics? Nothing? That's how horrific Elbit Systems is. They make the worst of the worst in the world not want to speak to them. Their image has largely taken a hit thanks to activists fighting back. Elbit had a black tie event recently for their largest richest investors, millionaires making millions from investing in weapons of death. But the group Palestine Action made sure the event did not go as well as it could have.
Elvis system, flawless people from Palestine and Kashmir, thousands upon thousands. Elvis system kills thousands of people daily.
Tonight you pay dress up to mask your war crimes, and the sight of it is disgusting. Won't you drink your champagne from Palestine to Kashmir? Blood spilled from the Western TV to kill.
Talk about a turd in the $12,000 Tiffany's Punch Bowl. Nothing ruins a high-end wearing a tailored suit and sitting next to the Duke and Duchess or whatever the fuck evening like a bunch of real-world humans with an actual moral core standing up in your face and reminding you that the lobster tail mousse you're gently munching on while talking about your investment portfolio is paid for by the deaths of thousands of children you never met nor barely thought about. That ruins an evening real quick. And that's why those people, those are my heroes. Like stop giving out awards on TV for the best 62-year-old man portraying a mentally challenged golfer in a feel-good movie. Start giving out awards for screaming in the faces of rich sociopaths. For giving the richest investment bankers indigestion. That award show I would tune into. Those are the real heroes. And that's the most sensitive news for this week. But also check out my interviews. I'm talking to Stella Morris this week, Julian Assange's wife. And you can get all of that at youtube.com/behindtheheadlines. But none of this is possible or available or can keep going without your help. We're completely independently funded. So become a member at patreon.com/behindtheheadlines and keep fighting.
That was a break. Well, let that be a lesson to Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! For not getting her top headlines up in time this morning. Lee Camp always serves it up hot and fresh, I'm telling you. Lee Camp. Now, that's from on YouTube. It's called Behind the Headlines. They have another website, and I guess he's starting to work for them. Lee Camp, hats off to Lee Camp for reading the news. And now we'll go right into the latest Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks about his new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent.
We'll hear from Justin about his work over the past 30 years getting innocent people released from prison.
We'll also take a look at junior ROTC programs on high school campuses around the country and a new development of automatic enrollments.
Our guest is Rick Johncow, who works for two San Diego-based anti-militarist organizations. Stay with us. I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
There is a common belief that if you're arrested, you're probably guilty because where there's smoke, there's fire. People assume that only the guilty confess to crimes, because why would an innocent person confess to a crime they didn't commit? And when a person pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury, that's the end of the matter in the minds of most people. In fact, many innocent people are arrested, especially people of color, due to racial profiling and other forms of discrimination by law enforcement. Implicit bias often infects the case as it moves through the criminal legal system, from the initial police stop to interrogation, arrest, charging, trial, and sentencing. This is particularly tragic when a person is charged with a capital crime for which the death penalty is imposed and that sentence is carried out. However, it is estimated that between 10,000 and 20,000 people are currently serving time in prison after being convicted of crimes they did not commit, largely due to prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct. Unfortunately, even when exonerated, the psychological and physical damage done is so extensive that many people are never able to fully recover from the trauma. In addition, when the wrongful conviction is solely the result of prosecutorial misconduct, those convicted have no legal resource to be compensated for the wrong done to them because of prosecutorial immunity. Criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks has spent decades working to free innocent people from prison. The founding director of the California Innocence Project, Brooks is the author of the provocative new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. In it, he discusses false identifications, junk science, lying snitches, and incompetent defense lawyers, which all too often lead to the imprisonment of innocent people. My co-host Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are fortunate today to speak with Justin Brooks about these injustices in the criminal legal system and how they can be remedied. Justin Brooks, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Since the 1990s, thousands of innocent people have been freed from prison. How many successes has the California Innocence Project had with exonerating the wrongfully convicted? How do you decide which cases to take? How do you fund your work? And how long does it generally take to exonerate an innocent person?
Those are a lot of good questions. So I've personally had the privilege of walking 36 of my clients out of prison, but this work has been replicated all around the country, and it's been really amazing to see other innocence organizations, defense attorneys, and sometimes even prosecutors who have played this role in exonerating innocent people, and the numbers keep going up every year. How do we decide which cases to take? That is actually the most difficult and most heartbreaking part of this work. When I started the California Innocence Project in 1999, I remember naively thinking to myself, how am I going to get cases? And the LA Times did an article about the opening of the project, and I started receiving boxes of mail, and that has not slowed down over the past two decades. So I have a team of law students, and I have 100 volunteer attorneys, and we receive thousands of letters a year. With every one of them, we look into the case. We send out questionnaires. We interview their trial lawyers. We read through their appellate briefs. And then twice a week, there's presentations in my office on the cases, and I sit there with the awful Caesar-like power of thumbs up or thumbs down of whether a case proceeds. And what's difficult about that is, in a lot of those cases, I know we may very well have an innocent person, and I just know from my experience it'll be impossible to reverse that kind of case, that we won't be able to develop the evidence we need to overcome the burden of proof, which we have once someone is convicted. And then your third question of how long does it take? Well, that largely depends on how much cooperation we get. The shortest exonerations I've had in my career that have been around a year have all involved prosecutors working together with us to get the exoneration. And the longest exoneration took me 27 years. I started the case when I was 29 years old, and I finished it a couple of months ago, and I am 57. So, yeah, it takes a long time usually.
There is now a national network of innocence projects throughout the country. Can you explain to our listeners the history of this movement?
Sure. Well, in 1998, there was a conference at Northwestern Law School where all these men came who had all been exonerated from death row. And it was a much more important event than we realized at the time. because there was a group of us who were there who got together and started talking about starting a network of innocence organizations. Barry Sheck was there from New York, and they had been working for several years in the Innocence Project in New York, and a few projects had started to crop up. So there was a project that started then in Chicago at Northwestern. There was one in Florida. There was one in Washington. There was the Arizona Justice Project. And I started the fifth project, it was either fifth or sixth, in California, in San Diego. And since then, this network has grown and grown and grown and really become a movement. And we now have 60-some projects in the United States. We have a network of projects in Latin America, in Europe, in Asia. And the reason it's really grown is because it's a universal problem that there are innocent people incarcerated all around the world, that there's no criminal legal system that doesn't get it wrong. And so it's really become a movement of freeing innocent people from prison.
Justin, what is the leading cause of wrongful convictions?
So that's kind of the whole exploration of my book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent, was I want to sit down and look at all the causes that I'd seen over the course of my career, and there are many. In sort of things like false testimony, it's hard to categorize as one thing because there's false eyewitness testimony, there's false victim testimony, there's false expert testimony in science. But basically the leading cause of wrongful conviction is evidence coming into court that's not accurate that ultimately leads innocent people to go to prison.
The wrongful conviction and imprisonment of innocent people is not the only problem with the criminal legal system. The constitutional right to a fair trial is routinely violated, even in cases where there may not be evidence of factual innocence. How does this impact the work you do?
Yeah, so when I started doing this work, I did feel from my buddies in public defense and my criminal defense attorneys of this sort of feeling of, well, you know, you're representing innocent people, but it's important that everybody get a fair trial. And I firmly believe that. I mean, I started my career as a criminal defense attorney, and most of my clients had committed the crimes, and occasionally I'd have innocent clients. But it's important that everybody gets a fair trial. And I think what the innocent movement has done is it's put a mirror on the criminal legal system in a way that wasn't happening. Because the problem is the general public only really cares when it is an innocent person. So, you know, those of us who are lawyers, we care about a system being fair and just, regardless of whether someone committed a crime or didn't commit a crime. They're entitled to a fair trial. They're entitled to have the evidence tested. But the problem was that the general public didn't care as much about that. And I think what we've accomplished through the innocence movement, or continuing to accomplish, is improving the criminal justice system for everybody, because now you have more people caring about it, more people engaged in it. You have more of a spotlight on it through the media and through television and movies and documentaries and conversations like the one we're having here today. So I think we've been an important partner in general in improving the entire system.
As a retired criminal defense attorney, I appreciate that very much, Justin. In recent years, there have been significant studies that have exposed the inaccuracies of eyewitness identification. And in fact, it's now been established that nearly 70% of all wrongful convictions in this country have resulted from inaccurate eyewitness identifications. How can the system be changed to minimize the incidence of false identifications?
Yeah, the numbers, when we look at the statistics and the numbers of people who've been wrongfully convicted due to bad identifications, the numbers are just shocking. And as you say, perhaps 70% of all wrongful convictions have resulted from inaccurate eyewitness identification. And I think there's a simple answer to that, and there's a very complex answer. Now, the simple answer is, there's a real disconnect between the actual quality of an identification in a courtroom and the weight that jurors give it. Because when someone walks in a courtroom and says, I'm 100% sure that's the person who committed the crime, most of the time the jury's going to convict. And they don't understand how that person got to that point of making that identification. they don't understand necessarily that maybe when the lineup was done or the photo array was done, the person wasn't that confident, and their confidence built up before the time they got to court. The evidence ultimately is what the jury hears, but the basis for it is often not that good. And the other thing is we're just not that good at seeing people and remembering them. I'll say to jurors and to groups of people I present to, I'll say, you know, have you ever been in a restaurant and you ordered one type of soup and you're looking right at the wait staff, there's bright lights, there's no gun in your face, and a few minutes later you change your mind and you can't remember who the person was. And that's just a few minutes later. Sometimes these identifications are done hours, days, weeks, months, and I've even seen cases of years later. And yet by the time that person shows up in court, they're very confident in the identification. So what can we do about this? Well, the first thing is to educate people about the quality of these identifications, that they're often not that good. And the second thing is to change our procedures. And in California, we've been battling that for 20 years. And finally, this past year, we got identification reform done throughout the state. And it starts with we've got to change the procedures for lineups. We know now that photo array lineups do not work and that you have to show people photos one at a time, or the comparison of looking at them together can distort what they remember. But the most important thing we need to do in these reforms is not allow police officers to be involved when they know who the suspect is, because they're not good poker players and they often give tells. And even sometimes when they do the process really well, and the witness will say, well, it looks a lot like number three, they'll say, okay, good job. And now that confirms in their mind that now the witness will go from it kind of looks like number three to when they're in court saying, I'm 100% sure it's that person. So there are many, many problems with identifications. I spend a chapter in my book talking about it. When I teach it in my wrongful conviction course, I spend hours talking about all the problems with it. And there are many, and you know, we don't have enough time to get into them all today, but one last one I'll just mention here is cross-racial identifications are the most shockingly bad identifications. And that's a tough thing to talk about, and I think lawyers are not necessarily comfortable always talking about race issues, and it really needs to be discussed that people have difficulty identifying people not of their own race. And it's just, it's not about racism, it's about exposure, particularly at a young age. And if your mom's white, your dad's white, your brothers and sisters are white, most of your community is white, you don't develop the kind of facial recognition software as a child that makes it easy to identify people of other races. And that, the whole world suffers from that. But it's that kind of education that we need to do.
Thanks so much, Justin. Having represented several clients who've been the victims of these types of inaccurate eyewitness identifications, I so appreciate the work that you're doing. Another serious cause of wrongful convictions is coerced confessions. Again, I represent several clients who have been the victims of that as well, some as young as 14 years old at the time they confessed to serious crimes. How frequently do these false confessions arise, and from what common police practices? How can the system be reformed, if at all, to minimize coercive police interrogations resulting in false confessions?
Record, record, record. I mean, it's just so crazy the amount of battles that have been fought about recording interrogations. And we still even sometimes hear the police saying they don't have the resources to do it when every person on the planet is carrying around a recording device in their pocket. But that we do not yet have a national consensus that requires the recording of police interrogations. And that's been something that we've been fighting state by state, county by county, across the United States. It's a battle around the world. And I just think it comes down to fundamentally, jurors should be able to see exactly how that statement came about in order to assess the weight to give that evidence. Because if all they have is the final statement given after 12, 13, 14 hours of interrogation, they're not giving the appropriate amount of weight to that statement. And what we find in our work is that after many hours of interrogation, people just get fed up. Sometimes they're broken down, sometimes they're confused, but a lot of times they're just angry, and they just say, okay, you know, give me the paper, I'll sign it. And they're thinking, what difference does it make? I didn't do anything, and they're not going to be able to convict me. But now maybe they get a bad identification, maybe they confirm that up with a snitch, and now the person goes to prison. So the remedy is very simple. We need to record all interrogations. We need to record basically all interactions between the police and the people that are being charged. And then we can assess the situation, and if they're, you know, questioned and it's appropriately done and the person gives a confession, then why wouldn't the government want the jury to see that? Because now you're seeing firsthand them making the statement. But this has been a battle that has been one of the most depressing battles on the front of wrongful convictions, because the remedies are very simple. They're not that complex, and yet it hasn't been done. And it's been a battle around the country. What's really behind all of this? It's behind being concerned about liability for misconduct and losing a case because the jury actually sees the whole picture. It's just part of the competitive enterprise of our criminal legal system that is problematic, that when things become competitive, then it's just trying to get the best evidence to get a conviction, not have all the evidence presented to the jury.
We're speaking with Justin Brooks, founding director of the California Innocence Project, about his new book, You Might Go to Prison, Even Though You're Innocent. Justin, jurors frequently expect to see scientific evidence, including DNA, fingerprint evidence, and ballistic evidence. Does every case involve one or more of these types of evidence? And how does expert testimony both contribute to and protect from wrongful convictions?
So DNA changed everything. DNA, before we could present DNA evidence in these cases, there was so much cynicism around the idea that anybody was innocent in prison. You know, there were people like Reuben Hurricane Carter, who was a hero to many of us, as a guy who was wrongfully convicted on basically no evidence except racism. But his case was one where there wasn't that kind of hard scientific evidence. So people could say, well, I still think he's guilty. And DNA came along and changed all of it. And so since 1993 in the state of California, been using DNA in the trial courts. And when I started the project, I knew that a lot of the DNA cases had already been gone through by 1999, and there was going to be a short shelf life on how many cases really did involve DNA, because of course DNA only becomes really significant in typically rape and murder cases. Now, that's proven not to be true, because as we've gone along over the last 20 years, we've seen advances in DNA where we can use mitochondrial DNA in robbery cases if you have hair samples and things like that. But the reality is today that it's a very small number of our cases that involve DNA, but DNA opened the door to judges granting petitions, granting hearings, opened the door to the media attention on innocence, and it just changed everything. So certainly every case does not involve DNA, but many, many of our cases involve other types of forensic sciences that have been both developing and improving. And we've also been disproving sciences that in the past we put far too much weight on. For example, bite mark testimony, to me, is one of the worst pieces of forensic evidence. Oftentimes, these are bored dentists with too much time on their hands who love CSI, because it is the flimsiest of forensic sciences. We've seen a lot of bad science in the arson area. We've seen a lot of bad science in shaken baby cases. So I think what our movement has done is both build up strong sciences like DNA and utilize them more and more, but also we've been able to disprove other sciences, sometimes using DNA, where we come in and say, look, they might have said the bite mark matched, but the DNA clearly shows this isn't the person. And so it's been very, very interesting. In my office, each one of my lawyers is assigned a different forensic science to make sure we have an expert in the office on each one of them, and they go to the conferences and read all the journals and network with the experts, because it's absolutely critical that we have that capacity in order to undo some of these cases.
Justin, you write in your book that 54% of wrongful convictions involve some type of official police misconduct, such as the use of lying informants or snitches. Please explain some of the ways that police misconduct plays a major role in wrongful convictions. And, of course, we know that many convictions have been dismissed due to this police misconduct around the country. What is testa lying, and why is it such a big problem?
Well, if you'd asked me this question 30 years ago, I probably would have had a different answer. But here's my answer as I approach my late 50s, in that I think most people get up every day and try to do the best they can. And I think that, you know, life is just a bell curve, that there's a small amount of people who are extraordinarily good at their work. Most of us fall into the good to okay. And then there's this percentage who are the terrible and the awful. And I think what happens with police misconduct is some of the police misconduct is just not being good at their job. Some of the police misconduct is trying to add evidence to cases where they really believe people are guilty and ignore evidence that could show innocence. And I think, and then some percentage of the cases are just absolutely awful people. And I think that's a small percentage, but it can have a huge impact. I mean, in California, we had the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles, where you literally had a unit of the Los Angeles Police Department acting as a gang and buying and selling drugs and planting weapons and doing outrageous behavior. And that does happen. That happens all over the country. You have those types of outrageous cases. But I think the thing that's more problematic is the larger number where people think they're doing their job correctly and are just not. And those are the kind of the incompetence that we see within the system. And that can be improved more than you can improve people who are just out to do bad things. So it is very discouraging that in a country where, and I work all over Latin America, so I've been dealing with, you know, we've got more than 30 innocence organizations in Latin America that I work with, and the police misconduct in Mexico, for example, is shockingly bad. I think in the United States what happens is it's more the bell curve, and we need to focus on that, and we need to, police the police better than we do.
Justin, we've been so appreciative of your insights and your experience in this area. Can you tell our listeners how they can follow the work that you do and that other innocence projects around the country are doing?
Sure. Well, they can go to our website, which is californiainnocenceproject.org, and hopefully pick up my book, available on amazon.com and everywhere else, and read more about the problem of wrongful convictions.
Well, thank you so much, Justin, for being with us, and we highly recommend your new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. On her first day of high school, Andrea Thomas and several other freshmen at Detroit's Pershing High School learned they were enrolled in a class called JROTC, or Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps.
School administrators told the students the program was mandatory. Funded by the U.S. military, JROTC requires students to wear military uniforms in class, recite patriotic declarations, and obey orders from an instructor who frequently yells at them. When several students tried to drop the class, officials refused permission, even though the Pentagon says that requiring students to take their programs runs counter to its guidelines. The New York Times recently learned that thousands of public school students were enrolled in JROTC either as a requirement or through automatic enrollment. Most of the schools with high enrollment numbers were attended largely by non-white students and those from low-income households. Critics of junior ROTC say the program's militaristic discipline prioritizes obedience over independence and critical thinking. And as we reported earlier on Law and Disorder and now noted by the Times, the program uses textbooks that often rewrite or downplay certain failings of the U.S. government. With its concentration in schools with low-income and non-white students, some also claim JROTC encourages students to enlist in the military rather than explore other routes to college or jobs in the civilian economy. Joining us to talk about the push toward JROTC in many of the nation's schools is Rick Jonko. Rick works for two San Diego-based anti-militarist organizations, the Project on Youth and Non-Military Opportunities, or YONO, and the Committee Opposed to Militarism in the Draft. Rick, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you and talk about the subject we're going to discuss.
Since junior ROTC was founded a century ago, its presence in U.S. high schools has been a point of contention. During the anti-war era of the 70s, protests over recruiting high schoolers to serve in Vietnam prompted some districts to restrict or even phase out enrollment requirements. Rick, how has it returned to high schools in such large numbers, and why are we seeing automatic enrollments?
That's a good question. I'm really not sure how many units existed in schools right after the Vietnam War. I do know that in the early 1990s, there were 1,500 high schools with the program. If there was any expansion going on between Vietnam and the 90s, it was very gradual and very low level of expansion. But what happened is in 1992, Colin Powell was the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under the first Bush administration. And he was reacting to what he saw following the Rodney King verdict when police were acquitted of beating him, and there was rebellion going on, especially in the streets of Los Angeles, and he cited that as his reason for wanting to push for an expansion of junior ROTC. In other words, it was a veiled attempt at social control. He realized that the program could teach certain values, and he thought that these would diminish the likelihood of the kind of rebellion, especially youth rebellion, that was going on. And so he proposed that the number of units be greatly expanded. I think the proposal was 3,500 schools. Now, 30 years later, it's almost reached that number. The issue of automatic enrollment has come up recently because of the New York Times article that exposed it. And we've known about it for some time, but the effort to try to bring attention to it was really difficult, and so we're really grateful that the Times did cast a light on it. Those automatic enrollments are taking place for a couple of reasons. One of them is that in order to maintain a junior ROTC unit, federal law requires schools to have at least 100 students or 10% of their student body in the program. So there's a lot of pressure on them to find ways to pack the classroom. The other main reason is that many, if not most, schools use the program as a substitute for mandatory physical education classes. I'm guessing that almost every high school requires some physical education for graduation. So they're using it because they've decided we'll just give students in junior ROTC PE credit. And school officials think that it's cheaper than hiring PE teachers. In fact, in general, that's very much untrue. But that's often the excuse that they will give for automatic enrollment.
Rick, talk, if you will, please, about current-day Army recruitment numbers and challenges.
Well, the Army has really struggled in recent years to meet its goals for new enlistments. And in just the last couple of years, they've had to reduce their public, the enlistment quotas that they have publicly stated to match the reality of a shrinking pool of interested and eligible young people. So they reduce those numbers, and hopefully they will have a positive impression on Congress saying we met our quotas, but they're reducing the quotas. But then in the last fiscal year, which was for 2022, the Army only reached 75% of its recruitment goal, which was 60,000 that they had as their goal. And the other military branches only met their goals because they manipulated basically pools of people who had enlisted with delayed reporting dates. Enlistees commonly join the military in the delayed entry program where they sign now, and then they don't have to report to begin training for up to 12 months. So the other branches of the military rely on those pools to predict how they will do in meeting quotas in the future. And what the Air Force and Navy have been doing is moving people from those pools into a more imminent reporting date, and that's how they have been meeting their quota for this year, or for 2022, I should say. So that's the situation, and it's not going to be improving anytime soon for the Army in particular.
Then is it accurate to say that junior ROTC is a recruiting mechanism? And also, in your opinion, is there an element of brainwashing in the programs?
It's absolutely a recruiting program, although the JROTC program itself denies that everywhere, and people who embrace the program deny it. But every time that supporters of junior ROTC have gone to Congress to request continued funding, they've repeatedly bragged about its positive role in recruiting. And in 2019, it was the Secretary of the Army, at that time it was Mark Esper, he testified that JROTC's presence at a school encourages kids to join the military at higher rates than anywhere else. And that's not just students in JROTC, but it's the effect that the presence of the program has on the rest of the student body as well. So it's definitely a recruiting program. They can deny it all as much as they want, but that doesn't change the facts. I definitely feel it's brainwashing because it's really obvious in the curriculum if one looks at it. In the textbooks and the training methods, you see this. The training methods include things like learning how to march, give and take orders, how to treat peers within military ranks that are assigned to them, and even learning marksmanship. And all of this together with the textbooks, is designed to condition students to look at the world and look at their country and society and their relationships through the lens of the military and see the military system as a model for civilian society. So it's definitely a form of brainwashing.
Rick, what is the marksmanship program, and is the NRA involved in it?
JROTC units often include an extracurricular option for students to learn how to shoot rifles. They even form rifle teams to compete regionally and nationally. And for the marksmanship training, they're often shooting ranges located inside school buildings. Not many people outside of the school know this, and so they often find it shocking when they hear about it. But it is the case that you've got these zero tolerance policies imposed on young people so that they can be suspended for bringing a squirt gun to school. But then students walk in through the school gates and they're handed a rifle and sent to the shooting range. So it's been an interesting experience when we have been talking in public about this, because people are just, they're totally shocked when they hear that this is going on. But that's the marksmanship program. And the NRA's involvement has been to give grants of money and equipment to specific schools to help them establish marksmanship programs and set up shooting ranges in the schools. And according to the Times, the New York Times reporting, that since 2015, the total value of those contributions has been $5 million. The NRA also gives out special badges to students who are shooting competitors. And they use the fact that they're involved to basically recruit new members, younger members, and raise money for their organization. They often show how much their grants are being used by high schools in NRA publications, for example, in fund appeals.
Rick, the New York Times review noted that among schools where at least three-quarters of freshmen were enrolled in JROTC, more than 80% of them had a student body composed primarily of Black or Latino students. Why should that concern us?
Well, the concentration of JROTC units in schools in poor neighborhoods and communities of color, you know, it leads to disproportionate numbers of their youth being targets for recruitment. And research has shown that the vast majority of former cadets who eventually join the military, they enter at lower enlisted ranks, not as officers. So one of the results is that it's feeding more youth of color and youth from low income communities into the lower ranks of the military, where they can be used as cannon fodder in our wars. So that's of concern. And another one is it can result the students' own expectations for their future. They're diverted, in a sense, away from college prep and outreach programs. We know of students at one inner-city school in San Diego, for example, who were talked into dropping a very popular and effective college prep program called AVID to choose JROTC instead. They left the AVID class to take JROTC. And then they found out later on that AVID was almost certainly going to get them into college, and JROTC contributed nothing to meeting admittance requirements for the university system in California. So it's just, that's what I mean. It's diverting them.
Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Rick Johncow of Project Yano and the Committee Opposed to Militarism in the Draft. Rick, in Philadelphia, a district spokeswoman said that one school, Martin Luther King High School, automatically enrolled all freshmen into JROTC to expose them to possible military careers and to, quote, create a culture of teamwork, collaboration, and discipline. What do you think Dr. King would have to say about that?
Well, first, I think the administrators of that school are capitalizing on Dr. King's name, and they don't even understand what he stood for. He once said that he condemned any organizer of war, regardless of rank or nationality. So I'm confident that he would have insisted that any school named after him focus on other non-militarized methods for creating those features of teamwork and collaboration and discipline rather than defaulting to the military for that purpose. And there are a lot of ways to teach those things. Music, athletics, student government, community service requirements can all do that sort of thing. So there's no excuse for that school to have that program, especially in one that's named after the chief advocate of nonviolence.
Rick, why do you think so many administrators and even some teachers praise the program for its building personal responsibility and leadership? Is this a replacement? You mentioned athletic programs before, but is it also a replacement for the lack of civics education in schools?
Well, I think we could definitely use more civics education in schools. That's been commented on quite a bit in the past, that there's less and less of that. But frankly, I think that the claims that they're making like that are designed to excuse complicity in aiding military recruitment and allowing activities like marksmanship training in their schools. They may have civics classes, but if you're going to promote an elective that teaches militarized values and ethics, how is that consistent with teaching a class that's supposed to give children civics education, especially in a country where supposedly civilians are the ones who are controlling our government and our policy and our values? It just does not make any sense.
I would imagine, Rick, that there are differences of opinion between administrators and teachers about the value of this program. It would be interesting to know what kinds of struggles they have. Can you please talk about the findings of Project Yano's textbook project?
Sure. This is a project that we initiated in 2020 where we assembled a team of reviewers to look at almost a dozen textbooks that were being used for JROTC by the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. And what they found was examples of whitewashed history, ethnocentrism, anti-Muslim propaganda, rationales for wars of choice, blatant military recruiting propaganda, antiquated gender stereotyping, and a lot more egregious content. But most importantly, it established that the textbooks fail when it comes to cultivating critical thinking among students, and that's what we should be doing in our schools. And they do the opposite, because what they're trying to do is cultivate obedience to authority, unquestioning obedience, and those are the things that are embedded in the curriculum. And by the way, if people want to see a full report of that review, they can download it from the Project Yano website. Projectyano.org has the document there.
Thank you for that, Rick. How are some civilian instructors dealing with military posters, recruiters on campus, and even the curriculum taught in JROTC classes?
Well, it's been challenging for teachers who are uncomfortable with all of that because they know that expressing a critical view of the military in their schools can lead to some serious pushback from not only administrators, but if they have a JROTC program, sometimes the students themselves will push back against teachers who are critical of JROTC. But some teachers have encouraged students to think critically about the issue, and they'll do it by inviting speakers into their classroom, for example, speakers from the kind of organization that I belong to, and sometimes anti-war military veterans. And then some of them have been willing to give support to students who choose to speak out about recruiters and JROTC, and it's been probably one of the most effective factors in triggering student-led opposition to recruiting in their schools and opposition to JROTC, that the support that teachers have shown, but it is a very risky thing for them.
What about instances where schools agree to reforms but don't enact them? You told the Times that it's almost like killing a vampire. What did you mean by that?
My quote was an expression of frustration over the fact that involuntary JROTC enrollment just keeps resurrecting wherever you think it's been stopped. And my personal experience with that is in San Diego, where the school district in 2008 was convinced to issue a directive banning enrollment in JROTC unless there was first fully informed consent by the student and parent. And we thought it had been resolved. And then the Times article now, you know, which is just a few months old, revealed that the problem has continued to this day in San Diego and other school districts as well. So that's what I meant by that quote. And I mean, it's just very frustrating to think that when you bring about such change, that the junior ROTC program is really calling the shots, so to speak, and they find ways to unravel what you've done.
Rick, a couple of years ago, legislation was proposed to expand the number of JROTC units and also to incorporate military recruiting as a formal part of the program's purpose, even though you've indicated that it actually is. Did anything happen with that legislation?
I think the proposal you're probably referring to did not survive in Congress as it was originally worded. However, the annual National Defense Authorization Act that was just passed recently for 2023 did commission the Department of Defense to develop a plan for future JROTC expansion. And I think that plan is supposed to be given to Congress sometime in the next 100 days or within 100 days after the bill was passed. However, funding for that expansion would still have to be approved in future years. So that's not a fait accompli.
Rick, what can our listeners who are concerned about this problem do to help quell the spread of JROTC in our high schools?
It's important to know that there's sort of two contexts for working to stop the spread of JROTC. One has to do with whether a new unit is being proposed in a school district where there never was one before. It's been demonstrated that it's much easier to block that. Activists have been able to stop those new units. They just need to be knowledgeable about it, and there are resources that they can access to help with that kind of work. I would refer people to the website of NOMI.org, which is the national network opposing the militarization of youth. The other context is one where people would like to remove an existing unit, and that is a much more challenging endeavor. I would say that 99% of the attempts made by activists to get rid of an existing unit fail. And that's because they use a frontal public approach. They go to the school board and they say, well, we want to get rid of JROTC. We demand that you take action. And as soon as that happens, it triggers a lobbying force that overwhelms their efforts. JROTC classes are military classes, and so the students can organize. They can pack the school board meetings. Their parents come, their uncles, their aunts, their grandparents, their friends, and it always fails. But on the other hand, it can be done. And the reason it can be done is because of that law that requires the minimum enrollment of 100 students or 10% of the student body. If there's anything that can be done to facilitate lowering the enrollment, once it gets below those minimum requirements, the unit is supposed to be disbanded. And ways to do that would include waging campaigns to ban involuntary and JROTC enrollment. Another way is to ban marksmanship training, because marksmanship training is used as a magnet to try to attract people to JROTC. So if that exists, that's another thing that could be used. But in any event, the approach has to be carefully thought out and strategic, and the methods for doing so have been documented. And again, the information on those methods can be found at the NOMI.org website.
Rick, we want to thank you for your decades' work organizing to raise awareness of these programs. We've unfortunately run out of time. Can you remind listeners how to follow your work and that of Project Jano?
They can contact us from the projectjano.org website or email contact@projectjano.org.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's a pleasure as always, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Same to you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Joining TaxCast, the latest TaxCast, here in the last half of the second hour.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That'll be coming on tomorrow at lunchtime, tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas. Don't miss out on it. Here's the latest TaxCast.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Let me know what you think of the show. What do you want to hear more about? What do you want to hear less about? I'm always happy to hear from you. Okay, so in this month's TaxCast, it may not sound like it, but this is history being made at the United Nations.
The committee will now take action on draft resolution L11 Rev 1. May I take it that the committee wishes to adopt draft resolution L11 Rev 1? I hear no objection. Draft resolution L11 Rev 1 is adopted.
We're going to give you our fly-on-the-wall take on what happened at the UN on November the 24th, 2022. We're going to look at the power plays around what really is the beginning of the end of the OECD's 60-year reign as the world's leading rulemaker on global tax.
I call to order the 25th plenary meeting of the second committee at the 77th session of the General Assembly.
Okay, so usually a meeting with a title like that would make my eyes glaze over. And a vote on a resolution called L11 Rev 1 wouldn't exactly set me on fire either. But honestly, it's a fascinating meeting. It's all the more interesting because of the power dynamics in play. Because in many ways, we're witnessing a shift in power. I'm going to put a link to the video in the show notes. It kicks off at about 20 minutes in. It's worth a look. But let's start by understanding what this resolution is and what nations have just voted for. Here's Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network.
Look, this is a great resolution, and yet it is much less than it could have been, much less than the original proposal from the Africa Group. I think we should say, first of all, what a just fantastic job the Nigerian delegation have done to get this through. I think without Nigeria's leadership, it's not clear who else would have stood up, and that's been vital in getting this really unprecedented success. So even in the state that it went through, the resolution really is a kind of watershed moment. There's three main elements to it. So first of all, most concretely, it calls for the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, to produce a report on the options for a framework at the UN for intergovernmental discussion and decisions on tax rules. So looking at the options and over the next 6 months or so delivering a report to the UN. Secondly, it calls for the beginning of intergovernmental discussions, not negotiations. That got watered down to discussions, but this is still significant. And that will see countries and regions coming together and starting to formulate their positions on these questions. To what extent do they want to see a full intergovernmental body on tax under UN auspices? What do they want it to cover? What issues, what aspects from transparency measures through to rule setting and so on? And what form do they think that should take? So it will effectively begin informally the process of negotiations. And then thirdly, the resolution calls for and establishes a session in the next General Assembly, so from September 2023, to discuss the Secretary General's report and to consider decisions. And that's where you'd expect to see a resolution of the form that this one originally took that basically fires the starting pistol on formal negotiations sets out a timetable for those meetings and a budget to support that negotiation process. So that's been delayed in a sense to next year, but what we've already got in place is very significant.
Yeah, and the Nigerian representative makes it really clear at this UN meeting about the interference and the attempts to water all this down. Let's listen here.
Nigeria is happy to be taking this historic first step, but we are also troubled that this resolution could not be more ambitious. Most countries also find it difficult to accept the legitimacy of international norms or forums that they have no effective voice in shaping. We also have not had a single globally inclusive forum on international tax cooperation. Unfortunately, the enormous pressure put on sovereign countries by the secretariat of another less inclusive international organization is regrettable, but something we hope we can all move past as we forge ahead together.
She's talking here about the OECD when she's mentioning pressure put on countries by another less inclusive international organisation. The OECD does seem to have seen this vote as a paradigm shift that threatens their dominance in the area of international tax, or they wouldn't have tried so hard to stop or weaken this resolution, right?
Yes, it's funny to hear the Nigerian statements referring to the very significant extent to which, although they don't name it, the OECD has lobbied its absolute hardest to try to get this blocked, and yet the resolution in the end went through unanimously by consensus. That's quite a condemnation of the OECD. In fact, their lobbying was thought by some to be so extreme that it actually put people off voting against this resolution who might otherwise have been more sympathetic.
So it backfired. Even though the resolution did get passed, afterwards a load of countries, largely OECD members, then complained about how they weren't happy about it after all.
Yes, I think, you know, from the OECD's point of view, they'd be pretty disappointed that although these countries are so unhappy, none of them was willing to actually go the whole way and object.
No, interestingly, they weren't willing. Joining us to analyse the vote on this historic UN resolution is the Tax Justice Network's Rachel Etapoya in Malawi. Rachel, what did you make of this UN meeting?
Naomi, and it was absolutely incredible to watch the proceedings at the UN, to see what was like a boxing match where the underdog Nigeria, representing the Africa group at the UN, alongside all other countries that have really been cut out of the international tax discussions, to stand up and say this is the time to change the rules of the game, to start negotiations on international tax. And it was so incredible because it is so different from how we've seen international tax negotiations over the last few years. The OECD, so the Club of the Richest Nations, former imperial powers, they've been setting the rules for the last 60 years. They've had their banquet and they've been eating at it. They did, in the past couple of years, try to bring in a few more, but it wasn't to the banquet table. It was really around it, catching the scraps. And in this so-called inclusive framework, countries were pressured to sign up to things that they maybe wouldn't have signed up to otherwise. And the African Tax Administration Forum called out political pressure and coercion of members in these negotiations.
Yes. And you know what's really striking to me straight away, just visually, when you watch this UN meeting, is that nations are all there. They're seated in alphabetical order. So you get Cameroon sitting next to Canada, Nepal sitting next to the Netherlands and New Zealand. Because if you compare that to the OECD, that's not the case at all for, let's say, Malawi, is it?
Malawi doesn't have a seat at this banquet table. It's not even in the room getting scraps. And there are other countries like this. So you cannot talk about inclusivity if you are not talking about the entire world. And you have to look at the power dynamics in the room and who actually is calling the shots. And even though there are challenges with the UN system, at least every country is sitting side by side.
Yes. And the African group of nations have really led the way throughout the process, all the way to the successful passing of this resolution.
Sorting out the international tax system, is really important for everyone, and it's really important for Africa. Africa is a net creditor to the world because of illicit financial flows, flows of money that flow out of the continent illicitly. You might assume that the greatest flows are from criminal and corrupt activity, but actually the high-level panel report from a few years back that assessed the scale of illicit financial flows by the African Union saw that 60% of the illicit flows out of the continent are actually through trade. And unless we sort out the international tax system, this is not going to change. Countries have already committed to curbing illicit financial flows, which requires a change in the international tax rules in signing up to the 2030 Agenda for Development, known as the Sustainable Development Goals. And part of the Addis Ababa action really explicitly states that we need to curb illicit financial flows if we're going to be able to finance the development that we need across the world. And this is also really explicit in Africa's own continental blueprint for development, the Africa we want, which is the Africa Union 2063 agenda. And delegates mention this as a reason for the resolution that we need to change the tax system to tackle illicit flows. So that's why it's so important to hear South Africa reminding all the other UN members in the room that they have an obligation to implement the Addis Ababa Action Agenda on financing the development goals, and part of that is tackling illicit financial flows, which requires a shake-up to international tax rules, because multinational companies are at the moment able to exploit the rules so that they can shift the profits out of the countries where they're actually doing business, where they're employing people, where they have the most customers, where they're extracting resources.
Yes, and so particularly the smaller, less economically powerful nations, plundered nations, the OECD really hasn't delivered. Just one example is with the minimum global corporate tax rate of 15%. I mean, a while back we saw countries like Nigeria rejecting that for many reasons, not least that it actually undercut their corporate income tax rate of 30%. Is the South African representative making a statement strongly supporting Nigeria's tabling of this UN resolution?
South Africa supports the resolution tabled by Nigeria on behalf of the African group entitled Promotion of Inclusive and Effective International Tax Cooperation at the UN. It is now 7 years since the world adopted the first ever target to reduce illicit financial flows, including corporate tax abuse, following the report of the High-Level Panel on Illicit Financial Flows out of Africa, chaired by South Africa's former president, Thabo Mbeki. This remains of critical importance for global efforts in support of sustainable development goals. Developing countries have for many years been calling for a global intergovernmental process to deal effectively with tax matters. Paragraph 29 of the Addis Ababa Action Agenda emphasizes that member states will increase the engagement on tax matters with a view of enhancing intergovernmental consideration of tax issues. We therefore believe that the time is now to realize one of the important aspects of the Addis Ababa Action Agenda with a huge potential for scaling up domestic public resources. By supporting the adoption of the resolution before us, member states are indicating their support for an equitable and just world and expressing support for the right to development for all states. A UN tax convention will set global standards and create the mechanism for transparency and accountability to address illicit financial flows and corporate tax abuse, amongst others. The UN is the most appropriate venue for this discussion due to its universal membership and all-inclusive character. We therefore call on all member states to support this resolution, thereby recommitting to strengthened international development cooperation. I thank you.
That's the South African representative there. In this UN meeting, we're hearing so many representatives of countries saying what a great process the OECD has for achieving better global tax rules for all nations, and saying how inclusive it's been.
Yeah, in the debate we're hearing a lot from the core OECD member countries about how the OECD process is perfect and we don't need anything else. But they're arguing from a very weak position. You know, clearly the OECD process is not inclusive. The OECD is, you know, in its own articles of association, is required to prioritise the economic interests of its own members. But also the inclusive framework process itself has been widely criticised by pretty much all of the non-OECD member countries in it, because it doesn't give them a vote, it doesn't give them an effective voice. They're really almost just there to sign on the dotted line, and that's become increasingly clear. But it isn't just that the OECD process hasn't been inclusive, it also hasn't been effective. So it hasn't delivered on its own timetable. So that really, even for the OECD members, I think they themselves know it's quite a stretch to say that the OECD process has done anything other than really slowly fail and take up lots of people's time and resources.
And even though this resolution gets passed unanimously in the end, look what happens here. I mean, the United States makes a last-ditch attempt to water it down even further by putting forward an amendment to the resolution for a vote. Here's the UN chair.
An amendment to Operative Paragraph 2 of Draft Resolution L11 Rev 1 was submitted by the United States of America and circulated in document A/C2/77CRP2. In accordance with Rule 130 of the Rules of Procedure of the General Assembly, the committee will take first a decision on the proposed amendment.
Check this out.
I now give the floor to the representative of the United States to introduce the draft amendment.
And now we get the vaguest explanation of this amendment from the US representative. I think they know it's going to fail and they're wasting their time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the facilitator of this resolution and fellow delegates. I will be brief. Hopefully all have had the opportunity to review the amendment we've put forward. Operative paragraph 2 calls for intergovernmental discussions at the United Nations in the spirit of undertaking a truly inclusive process to strengthen international tax cooperation. For this reason, the United States strongly feels that it is not in the spirit of beginning an inclusive process to prejudge the outcomes of these discussions in this paragraph. Our edit does not preclude any option from the discussions. It simply does not limit the conversation. We hope you will consider our amendment. Thank you.
Alex, what's the US trying to do here?
Well, this amendment was really very weak. What it tried to do was to water down the content of the intergovernmental discussions that will follow, to make them so vague as to be almost meaningless. So it was, you know, it was sort of a pure wrecking amendment. Word on the grapevine, and you know, you hear lots of things, so perhaps shouldn't put too much weight on this, but the word on the grapevine in New York was that the US had been very heavily lobbied by corporate lobbyists, and so they put this amendment down to, you know, because they thought they should, but then perhaps didn't push other countries as hard as the US sometimes does to support it. But I think it's also just, you know, a sense that there is an absolute clarity in a very large majority of UN member states that want this to go ahead.
So they're going through the motions without conviction. That is what it sounded like. Let's listen to this. So all the country representatives are now voting on whether or not to accept this US amendment to Nigeria's resolution.
The committee will now commence the process of voting on the amendment on draft resolution L11 Rev 1 contained in CRP2. Those in favour of the proposed amendment to draft resolution L11 Rev 1, please signify. Can we have the voting screen up, colleague? Yep, perfect. So those in favour, please signify. Those against, and abstentions.
The committee is now voting on the proposed amendment to draft resolution L11 Rev 1 entitled Promotion of Inclusive and Effective International Tax Cooperation at the United Nations, contained in document CRP2. Will all delegations confirm that their votes are correctly reflected on the screen? The voting has been completed. Please lock the machine.
I thank the Secretary. The result of the vote is as follows. In favor, 55, against, 97, abstentions, 13. The proposed amendment to Operative Paragraph 2 of Draft Resolution L11 Rev 1 is rejected.
Now, that is something the US is probably not used to. They got voted down.
Yes, I'm sure the US is really not used to not getting its own way, including at the UN. It's also a quite significant sign just how few countries were willing to back that.
Mm. And now that's out of the way, before Nigeria's resolution finally gets voted on, a number of nations are wanting to make statements. Here's Singapore having its say.
In the current climate, when the UN is expected to address ever more complex and evolving challenges, it is imperative, especially for delegations from small states, that we avoid duplication of efforts as far as possible and maximize the limited resources available to us. We are also mindful of the important work on this topic already being done at other forums, such as the OECD G20 Inclusive Framework on Base Erosion and Profit Shifting and its two-pillar solution. It is in this spirit that Singapore engaged in the negotiations in good faith and worked with like-minded delegations to put forward compromise proposals that reflect a delicate balance and diversity of views on this matter.
Alex, Singapore isn't an OECD member. Why do they seem so against a more inclusive UN forum for deciding tax rules?
Singapore's a funny one. I mean, it's kind of long been known that within the G77 group, which is 134, I think, countries of mainly with lower per capita incomes, former colonies and so on, Singapore has very often been the one that stood out on tax issues in particular and tried to block unanimity, and the G77 operates by unanimity. What we've heard, although this hasn't been publicly confirmed, is that in this case the OECD actively sought out high-level policymakers in Singapore and asked them to prevent a G77 position in favour of the resolution. Now, with Singapore being by far the biggest corporate tax haven within the G77, perhaps that's canny politics by the OECD, but it seems pretty destructive and really kind of puts the lie to any claim that they're fighting this because they care about ending tax abuse. You know, you choose your friends and allies in this game, and they seem to have done that here.
Interesting. And now the UK is wanting to speak ahead of the vote on the final resolution. Let's listen.
In recent years, we've collectively made significant progress at the OECD.
Who's we?
The Global Forum on Tax Transparency, the Inclusive Framework on Base Erosion and Profit Sharing, and the OECD's two-pillar solution are all significant steps in building a fairer international tax system for all, including developing countries. These initiatives are open to all. Non-OECD members participate in them on an equal footing.
I don't think so. And now the UK representative is making it clear they voted in support of the US's amendment. That's the one that just got voted down.
On the present resolution, we voted in favour of the amendments because the original language prejudges new initiatives at the United Nations, which could duplicate and potentially undermine existing OECD work.
A lot of nations use this word duplicate over and over throughout the session, which is quite interesting. Time for the vote now, the actual vote on the actual resolution.
The committee will now take action on draft resolution L11 Rev 1. May I take it that the committee wishes to adopt draft resolution L11 Rev 1? I hear no objection. Draft resolution L11 Rev 1 is adopted.
Now, you'd think that would be that, right? I mean, this historic resolution is passed. It's passed by consensus, so it's unanimous. But then there are quite a lot of sulky, antagonistic statements from some countries, which, after all, have just agreed to pass the resolution, right, Rachel?
So what I found fascinating at the proceedings was that after the US's blow didn't really land and didn't wipe out the strong resolution, and then all the nations, by consensus, passed the resolution that is going to pave the way for tax negotiations to happen at the UN. There was a series of speeches given, like additional blows as if the match hadn't ended. It was quite incredible. It was, countries were laying their cards on the table. So we saw OECD member states talk a lot about duplication of efforts because they say that through their programs, BEPS, which is Base Erosion and Profit Shifting, that they've been working on this and the UN shouldn't duplicate the efforts. But as we know, these efforts at the OECD have not been inclusive. So you have countries that enable the most financial secrecy according to the Financial Secrecy Index, the notorious tax havens like Singapore, the US, Luxembourg, coming out after the resolution is passed to sort of throw punches in the air and say, we don't like this because it might duplicate efforts or it's going to cost a lot of money, and still trying to defend their banquet table as inclusive, as effective. And you have to imagine the other delegates in the room who are not at that banquet table, or maybe just around the edge of that table in the inclusive framework, who are shaking their heads inside.
Yeah, we saw one nation after the other, overwhelmingly OECD member states, using this UN forum to kind of parrot very similarly worded objections about a resolution they all just reluctantly passed. It's like they're all reading from the same page.
This point we're hearing about, you know, the potential duplication of the OECD process, about the scarcity of resources, I mean, this is really, it's not a question for UN member states, it's a question for the G20 to consider. It gave this mandate to the OECD to set these rules in 2019, even after the OECD had effectively failed in the first attempt from 2013 to 2015. The G20 countries have given the OECD an enormous amount of resources to do this, while at the same time, the core members of the OECD have repeatedly starved the UN system, including the UN Tax Committee, of any resources to do its job. Oh, and let's not forget the Inclusive Framework member countries have been required to pay the OECD for their membership at a table where they don't have an effective voice or vote. You know, so we should be thinking about their scarce resources, and we should very much be encouraging them to allocate those scarce resources to a process where they do have the chance of an effective voice and effective vote. And that's only going to happen at the UN. So this isn't an argument that really holds any water at all.
No. And after the resolution is passed, the US representative gives a pretty strong and disappointed statement. Listen to this.
The United States joins consensus, but wishes to clarify its position on critical issues related to this resolution. We disagree with the notion implied by this resolution that there is not presently a highly inclusive forum working to strengthen international cooperation on tax. The United Nations intergovernmental process proposes a process that will tear down much of the progress that has been made in international tax cooperation since the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis, and will undermine the inclusive framework at the OECD, through which so much progress is being made. For that reason, the United States must dissociate itself.
Ouch! Sore losers. Remember that part of the resolution calls for the UN Secretary General to make a report on the next steps to enhance tax rule-setting leadership at the United Nations, something the Secretary General has supported. The US doesn't like that.
We feel calls for a new report by the Secretary General at this time are inappropriate. Establishing a UN-headquartered, open-ended, ad hoc intergovernmental committee to recommend new actions will undermine efforts both to stabilize the international tax system and help it become fit for purpose for the 21st century. Thank you.
And as for what the Liechtenstein representative says, I really can't take this seriously.
Madam Chair, the strengthening of international cooperation on taxation matters has been a long-standing priority for Liechtenstein. As a member of the Global Forum on Transparency and Exchange of Information for Tax Purposes, as well as the OECD G20 Inclusive Framework on Base Erosion and Profit Shifting, Liechtenstein is committed to international collaboration to tackle tax avoidance, ensure a more transparent tax environment, and strengthen the rule of law.
Yeah, Liechtenstein. I mean, Liechtenstein has, I think, for a long time at the UN, been very much at the forefront of European jurisdictions fighting any kind of tax or transparency progress. To hear them say, you know, we're against this because we're really strongly with the OECD's efforts against tax abuse, you know, really confirms just how far jurisdictions like that are so heavily involved in facilitating tax abuse, see the OECD process as being on their side. You know, the rest of us can draw our own conclusions.
And Rachel, your personal favourite, or should I really say unfavourite, statement after the resolution was passed is from South Korea.
I found it quite astonishing to hear South Korea in quite a patronizing manner say that the Africa group had not followed the correct process in drafting the resolution. They even explicitly stated, this delegate from South Korea, that they do not agree that an inclusive discussion can take place only at the UN. I mean, that's convenient to say when you're sitting at the OECD's banquet table, isn't it?
Exactly. Let's hear what the representative of the Republic of Korea has to say on the drafting of the resolution. It's pretty strong stuff.
It was deeply unfortunate to see, in the first place, a draft simply tabled to establish a new legally binding mechanism without any preparatory work to accommodate different views and identify common ground. The draft, which was supposed to serve as a basis of the negotiations, only referred to unrealistic promises to create a new mechanism and ignored all relevant achievements, efforts, and progress accumulated over a very long time. This year's process should not constitute a precedent for our future process and must not ever be repeated again. The Republic of Korea agrees on the need for ensuring more inclusiveness and effectiveness in international tax cooperation. My country, however, does not agree that an inclusive discussion can take place only at the UN. The discussion should be guided by a pragmatic and effective approach instead of a political and simplistic one. We may have to ask ourselves if such a rushed launch of the UN consultations could promote and advance the relevance of the UN and the Second Committee and ensure genuine inclusiveness. It might be convenient and easy to rely only on binary views like developed and developing when we see the world, but especially for tax matters, with such an approach, we are certain that we will not be able to reach any meaningful outcome.
Wow, she's been quite rude there in saying the African group of nations brought this process forward in a rush and in a simplistic way. I mean, they've been working on this for years.
And some explicitly say that actually what you're saying isn't correct. I mean, the Eritrean representative speaking on behalf of the Africa groups says that we need a space that has equal footing for tax negotiations, clearly meaning that the OECD process and inclusive framework is not that.
Right. And here's the Eritrean representative.
Tax-related illicit financial flows, including tax evasion and avoidance, are global problems and require global solutions and global cooperation. And no other multilateral fora is better than the United Nations to address such challenges and provide inclusive solutions. Effective international tax cooperation remains neglected in the global economic governance. It needs concerted joint efforts to bridge that gap through a comprehensive United Nations framework on tax. Developing and developed countries need to join forces in pursuit of just global UN-led solutions. The African group stresses the need to promote tax cooperation and the establishment of a governance structure where all member states can participate on an equal footing, contrary to the structures that we have today. The group stressed the need to reinforce the global fight against illicit financial flows, including tax avoidance and evasion, by increasing transparency and cooperation between governments and by creating more coherent and less complex global tax rules, standards, and structures that fully take into consideration the interests, concerns, and needs of developing countries. This resolution is a milestone toward ensuring a high standard of transparency. The resolution aims to ensure cooperation among all member states to establish one coherent global system designed to work for all countries and not just a few.
And I guess at the end of it all, after all is said and done, Nigeria's representative speaks so powerfully about how historic the resolution is and what it means to the sovereignty of African nations and other nations who finally have a place at an inclusive table.
Madam Chair, Nigeria's presidency of the 74th General Assembly had jointly convened with Norway as President of Economic and Social Council, the High-Level Panel on Financial Accountability, Transparency and Integrity for Achieving the 2030 Agenda. One of the recommendations made over a year ago was the need for a fully inclusive and effective international tax cooperation at the United Nations. Madam Chair, African ministers publicly have stated their desire for a United Nations staff convention 6 months ago. We look forward to taking further steps as urgently as possible. We have only 8 years to realize our ambitious 2030 agenda. We will not achieve it unless we step up the pace of our efforts to reshape multilateralism for the 21st century. I thank you.
That's the Nigerian representative. Alex, will this resolution really help African and other nations do that? I mean, we can hear in this session from the US and many other nations that although this resolution was unanimously passed by consensus, things seem far from consensus. Some of the world's most powerful countries don't like this at all. What are the battles ahead now? The hopes and the challenges?
This is such an important question. Again, I want to reiterate just what a great job Nigeria has done with the full backing of the Africa Group. And they're really right to say there's only 8 years left, almost, you know, eight going on seven. The Sustainable Development Goals were inaugurated in 2015 and included the first ever commitment to curb illicit financial flows, including from the panel chaired by Thabo Mbeki, the high-level panel on illicit financial flows out of Africa. They're dominated by corporate tax abuse. So it's really crucial that we get policy progress in that area. We also have, within the Sustainable Development Goals, tax identified as the primary means of implementation. So everything that the world has committed to in terms of the 2030 agenda really depends on effective progress against international tax abuse that drains the world of perhaps $500 billion in revenues every year and forces inequalities systematically higher. The point, I think, now going into the discussions is whether, in good heart, the EU, the US, the UK, Japan, Korea, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, whether this set of countries wants to carry on blocking to try to keep their disproportionate power at the OECD intact at the expense of making effective progress against tax abuse. They have to really decide and come out and say it. Do they want to keep a bit more power, power that they can't make effective, or do they want to become part of a bigger and genuinely inclusive process that has the potential to finally deliver effectively against international tax abuse, against illicit financial flows, and for the 2030 agenda that they've all signed up to? We're starting to get to the point that countries have to make their positions clear and be judged accordingly. There's no more room to hide in the opacity of the OECD process.
You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.